on the floor of his mother and father's home, listening to the fact that Sputnik had just been launched, and later on listening that the dog Laika went into space, and Ham, the American monkey that went into space, and eventually Yuri Gagarin went into space. He was collecting that information way back then, and he hasn't stopped ever since. WS2N, K2IW, go ahead, Paul.
Yeah, very good. Yeah, October Sky, good movie. let's see, 5 years old when that went up. That was 1957, October 4th. Yeah, very good, Dick. Gonna ask about Voyager, of course. We have to hear about that. Voyager 1, 130.7, so in a couple of, maybe a month or two, a couple of months, we'll be up to, 131 for Voyager 1. And the other one, Voyager 2, is at 107.3. two wonderful, good spacecraft. I think that was money that was left over from the early space program. Like a momentum budget, you know, from after the Apollo days, Viking missions and the Voyager missions, really, it was such momentum that I think that's the reason those things were built. We dropped them. There's quite a few things here tonight. I know there's a launch tonight at 11:34 out of Florida. SpaceX is launching another rocket. Did one about 3 weeks ago, so they're really accelerating their ability to launch rockets. This one they're sending up two at one time. This geosynchronous orbit. It's gonna take a long time for them to get there. They have ion propulsion for the final stage to bring them to the geosynchronous point. And because they, each one, you know, each one's probably about 5,000 pounds, a little bit less than that. So roughly a 10,000 pound payload. That's a lot of weight. So SpaceX is not going to try to bring the booster back to the autonomous ship, but try to reuse it back there. They didn't even bother putting landing legs on this time, knowing that that, you know, that's the situation. The next time they do that, we'll be back. Let's see, we think, what do we call that, number six. That would be the sixth cargo mission up to the International Space Station, and that will be in April. Wait, how am I coming through, Dick? I'm coming through Selden.
You're coming through very well, Paul. You could hit the audio just a little bit louder, but nice, clean signal-to-noise ratio. Go ahead.
Yeah, I was on earlier this evening and talking to Andy, and I was not really making it into Glen Cove, so it seems like every time it snows lately, that seems to be the case, so I'm better off to sell. But yeah, I just want to mention this one company that's successfully taken a parasail and brought it up to over 100,000 feet in a balloon. And the name of the company is called Worldview, and their goal is to eventually carry people. I'm going to put a half a dozen people plus two crew members inside of a, I'm going to call it a spaceship, but it really isn't. It's really an enclosed gondola at the bottom of a helium-filled balloon and bring it up to that level, over 100,000 feet. And they were successful in doing this, and the thing floated on parasail, loaded all the way back down to Earth, and eventually their goal is to charge $75,000 a person to get kind of like to the edge of space. You know, it's not really getting to the common level, which is the 100 kilometer area. They'll be down, you know, it's like 300,000 feet up or something, but they've only gone up 100,000 feet, but you still get to see the curvature of Earth. They'll be in a sealed capsule, so they won't need a spacesuit. Actually be able to walk around. This company is subsidiary of Paragon. Paragon is doing a lot of work. They've done work for NASA. They've done work for the Mir space program. When that was in effect, they helped them with regenerative processes, you know, breathing and fluids and all of that. And the company is run by two of the people that were originally in the bio sphere too, back in the 90s, woman and a man. They started Paragon, and now this offshoot company is called Worldview. In about 2 years, they expect to pull it launch, but, you know, they're going to blow it up to the edge of space. And God knows we'll be hanging from a parasail, and eventually they'll start coming down and let air out of the, or helium out of the balloon, and it'll come down to a more acceptable level, and the parasail will be released, and this closed gondola will come down to Earth, eventually landing on skis, you know, for not wheels, but they'll have skids on the back bottom of the craft. So a lot of people trying to get into the private market. Of course, SpaceX is really involved, and eventually they plan on carrying tourists as well. With the Bigelow Space Station being planned, call it Space Station Alpha by Bigelow. They'll have a place to bring people eventually when the International Space Station ceases to exist. And right now there's no sign of that ending. They're funded up until 2024. But maybe they'll have two places to go. Boeing will be launching the CST-100 with a crew up to 7 people. And the same for SpaceX in their Dragon. They'll be eventually launching up to 7 people as well. So that should be pretty interesting. You know, so many launches. For instance, this month alone, there's about 13, 14 launches worldwide, so we can't cover them all here. But there's, you know, a couple of interesting ones. There's the MMS launch coming up on the 12th of this month. Magnospheric multi-scale spacecraft they plan on launching from Florida on an Atlas V rocket. I don't know if you've ever read anything about this. I think I've mentioned it maybe once or two times on the net in the past when they were getting involved with this. But the idea is to study what they call a magnetic reconnection. Different places throughout the universe, the sun, galaxies, neutron stars, black holes, including the Earth. We have a magnetosphere, and when the magnetosphere breaks apart and then reconnects, when it reconnects, it lets off a tremendous amount of energy, and then particles go flying off, you know, sometimes almost the speed of light. They're trying to understand this, so they're setting up this spacecraft on the Atlas V in a couple of weeks, called the Magnetic Spheric Multiscale Spacecraft, that's going to fly. It's going to be a highly elliptical orbit, a very low, maybe they said like a half of a radii. They use radii, half Earth radii, beginning and going up to 25, all the way up to 25 Earth radii to study this effect. It timed out, but spacecraft, let me shorten it anyway, has four spacecraft on board the Atlas. And when you stand next to it, if you were to stand next to it in the preparation room where they prep these things, they have one on top of it, another, and that all gets put on the top of the spacecraft. But if you were to stand, it would look like you're standing next to a three-story building. Each one is octagonal in shape. They'll be flying in a formation, full of tetrahedron formation. So it's kind of like a pyramid if you were to take four spacecraft and just put them out in one location. And if you were to draw a line between all four, it would look like a pyramid. By having this, they'll get a three-dimensional effect of this magnetic reconnection that's going to be going on. We'll look forward to that launch. And I have a couple more things here, Dick, that I really can't let go. Next week, Dawn is, the spacecraft Dawn is going to be going into orbit around Cirrus, biggest asteroid out there. Of course, it's out in the asteroid field between Mars and Jupiter. It's been trying to get there for the last two years or so, ever since it left last asteroid that it visited. So, Dick, I'll pass it over to you for any questions. A couple more things, but I don't want to eat up the whole time here. This is WS2N. By the way, I can be reached at spacenetreport@gmail.com. If I get questions in for the TechNet, space-related, that's one way to do it. Back to you, Dick, K2RIW, WS2N.
Good stuff, Paul. Voyager, our favorite spacecraft, Real DX, 130.7 astronomical units. Since an astronomical unit is pretty close to 93 million miles, that means it is 12.16 billion miles away. At the speed of light, 18.11 hours one way, 36.22 hours. In other words, you send a signal to Voyager, say, how, why you doing, hi, and if you get an immediate answer, it takes 36.2 hours to get an answer at the speed of light. Wow. Now, when it comes to Dawn, I saw a report this week that Dawn is now getting close and taking photographs of the asteroid Cirrus, and is getting considerably higher resolution pictures than Hubble has ever gotten. It's got this great advantage that it's getting within hundreds or tens of thousands of miles, so it's getting much closer than Hubble could be with all of its magnification. As such, they're seeing these very, two or three very bright white spots. Let me drop. Where the white spots are Sirius, could just not quite be resolved with Hubble. But now Dawn is starting to really resolve them. It still hasn't gotten close enough to really resolve. They're extremely bright white areas. They don't know quite how big they are. In other words, the camera on Dawn hasn't yet resolved them. But do you have a guess as to what's giving them such high luminance, reflectivity, three spots? As Dawn rotates, you see these extremely bright spots that are not on the equator of Dawn, so to speak, and not at the pole. I'm having trouble believing that they could be craters. Has somebody set up a corner reflector? I mean, the amount of light you're getting from these white spots is almost what you would be getting with a tetrahedral corner reflector. Got a guess as to what that could be? I wonder if you've seen that report, Paul. WS2N, K2RIW.
Yeah, the Hubble has actually saw that, you know, but now, of course, going season, it's getting very close. And they expect to resolve this whole issue once Dawn gets into orbit. So it'll get close enough to get a good idea of what's going on. And right now they're guessing. Yeah. Pretty much read what I read. Definitely guessing at what this is. I'm more fascinated with Dawn's ion engines. There's three of them on board. And they left Vista 2 years ago. Orbit around that asteroid, and now going into a second orbit. That'll be the first time any spacecraft has done that. You know, orbited one celestial object, left, and then orbited another one. Unless you count Earth, you know, you send something into Earth orbit, then you go into a TLI, translunar ejection, and send it off to the moon, and let it go into orbit around it. But outside of that, it's quite a accomplishment. And I shouldn't really leave this portion of the net without mentioning one thing. The astronauts have had one heck of a time, good time actually, for the last week. They've gone on three separate EVAs on the International Space Station, and to get back to the commercial rockets that are going to be going up there, they need new docking platforms. So actually Boeing came up with the design, and they built the International Docking Adapter, the IDAs, and there's two of them that will be brought up this year. Two separate flights will be brought up in the trunk of the Dragon spacecraft by SpaceX, and then the Canadian Arm 2 robot arm attached to the space station will install it, help install the this thing. There'll be a spacewalk by Scott Kelly and another astronaut to actually connect this thing. Then eventually they'll have a second one go up. Well, these international docking adapters that they're going to be installing need power, data. They need to have power transfer, be able to send solar power to the spacecraft that'll be docked for, you know, maybe 6 months or a year attached to the space station. So all these cables and things have to be routed. So due to this, they've had three separate missions. One to do what I just said, routing all the cables to power up these future docking ports or international docking adapters that are being brought up this year. Another spacewalk to prepare different relocations of modules that have to be done to accomplish this. The end result will be two docking ports for crewed spacecraft. So, for instance, you could have a Boeing CST-100 and a Dragon spacecraft docked at the same time on the space station, if you'd like. Plus, at the same time, you'll have two berthing ports, so you'd be able to have, for instance, the SpaceX Dragon with supplies that came up also docked at the space station. And now Boeing has also agreed to create a cargo version of its CST-100 that it's now presently building for astronauts to fly on. So you'll be able to actually have four spacecraft attached to the International Space Station, to the Harmony node, and also to the Unity node. An interesting process, and today was the last spacewalk in record time, 5.5 hours. They thought it was going to go in at least an hour longer. It did very, very good. They ran 400 feet of called coax RF cable, because the goal on today's mission was to install two towers, very short towers, but antenna towers, and then a couple antennas on top of them. And what they are going to be communicating with the new spacecraft that come up there. They need a new communication system, not only for voice, but for data. And they put one on the right side of the space station and one on the left side. So on the starboard three truss section and the port three truss section, they installed, you know, one guy went on one side, one guy went on the other, and they installed these antennas. So I thought that was pretty cool, and they ran a total of 400 feet of cable, really four cables, you know, probably 100 feet each, back to the Destiny. To the Destiny module. Destiny module is the American science module. That's where we kind of like control everything. And they said they ran the cables back to Destiny. So it'll be all ready, ready to go in about another year or so. Probably maybe as early as the end of 2016, or probably most likely the beginning of 2017, you'll be able to see the first flights of these two corporate spacecraft that will eventually help us get out from under the $70 million price tag per astronaut that the Russians are charging us to go up on the Soyuz spacecraft. Dick, over to you. This is WS2M.
Well, I'm glad that Paul made improvements on the communication link between the eastern input and the western input. I'm listening to how well I'm coming out of the western machine, actually, eastern machine, and it's a little bit muffled sounding, but your audio going from east to west is very good. So that path has been made very operational. In the case of the Dawn spacecraft that left Vista and went to Cirrus, where it's about to go into orbit around Cirrus with its bright spots and eventually be resolving them. To leave Vista, the most efficient way to leave would be use the ionic engine, not the chemical engines, because you get a lot more efficiency out of an ionic engine. And if I'm in orbit around something like Vista, and I start applying prograde velocity with my ionic engine, I eventually spiral outward to a bigger and bigger orbit, and eventually I leave orbit. So leaving orbit of a gravitational object with a ionic engine is relatively easy. Let me drop. And then you blast with your ionic engine to get from Vista to Cirrus, and I'm guessing Cirrus is in a higher orbit, or further from the sun orbit is my guess. So you're doing a prograde velocity increase to get to the higher orbit of Cirrus, in my guess. And now to go in orbit around Cirrus, if I started applying braking action with the ionic engine, if I don't have enough braking action, I make a parabolic arc, but I fly by Cirrus. That's not good. So one way to get into orbit is either to choose an orbit that at first is so extremely big that I can be captured and then slowly spiral down to Vista. That's one approach. Or the other approach would be to shoot for Vista, just a little bit off to one side, and make a blast out of a chemical rocket, which would give you a hell of a lot more thrust and get you in orbit real fast. I wonder which way they did it, Paul. Did they leave Vista by way of spiraling output slowly with the ionic engine? And were they able to use the ionic engine to get in orbit to Vista? Or is it going to take a blast of the chemical engine to get captured? WS2N, K2RIW in the TechNet.
WS2N, yeah, no chemical engines are going to be used. No, whatever chemicals they have, they use for thruster adjustments, change attitude or whatever. Momentum wheels that they can spin up and fall, for attitude of spacecraft. But as far as propulsion, I mean, this thing was launched in 2007, Dick, so they've only used the ionic engines, and I say plural, they have three on board, and not like the smart spacecraft. The smart spacecraft had one that was like a prototype. Oh, that works good. Let's put three on Dawn. And they don't all fire at the same time. They'll fire different ones at different times. I give one a break and the other one will fire, but it's only one at a time. And they'll fire for years. And that's how they got into orbit around Vista with the ionic engine. They basically slowed themselves down and got themselves captured by that asteroid. And just like what you said, to get out of the gravity well, they just increased the speed until they eventually broke orbit. You know, the orbits got bigger and bigger. They, broke free, and then they start going forward, in a forward direction away from Vista and on the way to Cirrus. Now, which one is further out, I don't know, but, Cirrus is ahead of it, let's put it that way at this time. Now they're going to slow down. Only ion engines, that's all they're using. After this, they're going to be pretty much out of fuel, so that's going to be the end of the mission. This thing's going to stay in orbit, and that's all there is. Back to you, Dick. I timed out, but it's going to stay in orbit. They're going to run out of fuel, and so they're not going to break orbit after this.
Question. Yeah, question recognized. We'll get to you in a second. You didn't time out when it comes to what we heard on the Western Machine poll. We heard you continuously. I'm going to take the question right now. Please tell us your call letters and your name and proceed with your question. K2RAW in the TechNet. My name is Dick.
Hey, Dick. I've been listening here, you know. And, you know, I'm all for the space program. I think it's fantastic, you know. But here's a question I got for you. The country, you know, is financially in a hole that we'll never get out of. They're crying the blues because we have no money, you know, for this, for that program, for that program, for this program. But meanwhile, they have all this money to go to space. And for what? What are they trying to accomplish up there? And we have a ton of problems down here that government programs are going out of business. Can you answer that question, please? KC2UJL.
I feel where you're coming from, Tony. And if you look at the programs of any kind of pure research, you've got space, you've got the Large Hadron Collider in Switzerland being partially funded and supported by the United States. You've got the Fermi Laboratory, you've got the Stanford Linear Accelerator. There are lots of places where various kinds of pure research are taking place. If I took your attitude to the max, you would stop all pure research everywhere. You would try to feed the poor, and you would try to do nothing but good works with your money. And without any research in any area, a hell of a lot of educated people, believe it or not, would lose purpose. An awful lot of research, you don't know what the outcome is going to be, but it is beneficial. I mean, when it comes to the Apollo program, for instance, the United States gained a hell of a lot of international prestige. Let me drop. And so you could say the Apollo program, which cost $32 billion in 1970 money, you could say it was a waste. But it did get us out of the Cold War, so to speak. We were in a nuclear battle with the Soviet Union. We were building all kinds of bombs and aircraft and submarines and whatever to protect us from what we thought was a terrible enemy. And you could say the space program is where we started getting friendly with each other. Now, there's another way of looking at it. Paul could give us the exact numbers. The possibility exists that the whole United States space program is costing you and I, I'm going to pick a number, $5 per year, per American citizen. Maybe it's 50 cents per year. It's some number like that. And you're asking, are you getting your money's worth? For the people who are interested in space, the majority of them would say, yay, verily, I'm getting my money's worth. I get a chance to read all these articles about the astronauts doing spacewalks and developing new drugs in space and so on. So it's a very difficult situation should you ever do any kind of research. I mean, no matter what kind of research you're doing, you don't know what the benefit is going to be until you make the discovery. And a hell of a lot of things that you never thought would make a discovery have saved people's lives. It's a difficult one. I know where you're coming on this one, Tony, and there's no great answer for it. But you can't stop all research. Lots of smart people have studied it at the conclusion they've come to. KC2, UJL for a rebuttal. Go right ahead, Tony. K2RAW in the TechNet.
Hey, Dick, how you doing? Oh, I got my daughter works for the federal government. And she was, matter of fact, she was just transferred to Washington, D.C. You know, this country is in a real financial problem, you know. I don't know what's going on with the space program. I don't know what we're trying to accomplish here. You know, is it going to cure some kind of a disease? You know, because the money they're using there, like you said, 50 cents per person or a dollar a day per person. You know, when you reach 65 years old, you got to go down to Social Security and try to talk to the government and get your money. it's easy to get on the space program. Now, you know, I'm just kidding around. And to get your social security check that you've been working for 30 years. You see? And all they do on the news is constantly drag the same cigarette. You know, we're in a whole $30 trillion and this and that. But meanwhile, through all that mess, we managed to find the money to send a spaceship out to outer space. And I don't want to tie up the net, Dick.
Paul, there's a chance you know the answer to this. Give me a very rough number. Roughly how many billion dollars per year right now is going into the space program? You're going to see where I'm going with this. How many billion dollars per year is the United States spending on the space program right now? Very rough guess, to the nearest few billion dollars. Go ahead, Paul. WS2N, K2RIW.
Yeah, there. NASA is being cut little by little, but now the last couple of few years they got a little bit of an increase here and there. But they've been hovering around the $18 billion area for many years. That's the average number. So to give you an idea, James Webb Space Telescope that's going to go up in 2018. They've been working on this thing for 10 years. And we figured it out on the net before, Tony, and it comes out to a cup of coffee per year for every taxpayer in the United States. And that's well worth it, in my opinion. To pay for the defense program that we got going in this country, we need it, of course, but to pay for it, forget about that one cup of coffee. How about maybe the most expensive restaurant you could find in Manhattan and go there all week long, and maybe that would be the equivalent of what you're going to pay. Apollo 11, when that was going to go up, people said the same thing, and it was 1969. Look at all the poor people, and what are we going to do about this, you know? And naturally, you had a lot of people, politicians and people that were involved with social work, that were all involved with the same kind of comments. And one of the people that visited the mission control for the Apollo 11 mission was the Reverend Ralph Abernathy. And I have it in one of my books, but I'm paraphrasing here. But basically, they asked him, the flight director, asked him, I understand the problems with the country at this time, but what do you think? You know, I mean, do you think we could really solve all the problems if we cancel this Apollo 11 flight and just hand all the money over to all the poor people right now? Do you think that's possible? And with that, Ralph Abernathy said, looked at Chris Pratt, the director of flight control, and I'm paraphrasing, but he said, push the button. There's no way. It's not going to happen. Push the button. Cancel this program. It's not going to work. It's nowhere near enough money to help all the poor in this country. Back to you there.
Hey, you're giving us some good numbers. I did a very rough calculation, Tony. $18 billion per year is presently being spent, in Paul's rough estimate, on the NASA space program. The United States has roughly 330 million residents. You divide 330 million into 18 billion, and you get $54.50. In other words, the space program is costing every American citizen $54 per year. It turns out to be 15 cents per day. You said a cup of coffee. You can't buy a cup of coffee for 15 cents. So you and I are paying 15 cents a day, Tony, to support the space program. And if all of that money that is being spent on the space program was now handed to every citizen, they'd get $54 a year. You Is that going to solve your and my Social Security problem? An extra bonus of $54 a year? Not a chance. NASA also can claim they get roughly a 5-to-1 fallout. In other words, for every dollar NASA spends, you get $5 worth of benefit for the American public. Advances in computers, advances in medical research, ceramic materials, high temperature materials, low temperature materials, and so on. A hell of a lot of the economy of the United States. Let me drop. A hell of a lot of the economy of the United States is that money going to vendors that are building the hardware that supports the space program. Those vendors have people working for them, which gives them a salary, allows them to pay Social Security so that when they retire, they now have a job that they had that gives them a payback in Social Security payments. So as you can see, it's complicated. But any one of these generally beneficial programs can't just suddenly cut it off saying you're not getting your money's worth. There's lots of evidence that we're getting a 5-to-1 payback on so-called fallout. I know that, Tony, you wanted to tell us something about safety, and you mentioned it earlier, and now is a very good time. So why don't you give us your safety information that you were mentioning earlier, Tony. KC2, UJL, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Hey, I'll bring up something I saw on television, on HBO special. There's oncologists doing studies on cancer. They're giving cancer a virus. They have some very powerful viruses that they can inject in an operation room. They can give it a cold, a very serious cold, like 10,000 times pneumonia. And they're finding out that it's killing the cancer cell. Also, I wanted to mention, Dick, people are talking about RF energy. They have a tool, a very fine transmitter that can transmit on the end of a needle an RF signal right into a cancer cell.
Yeah, the RF ablative technique, I think it's called, but because many types of cancer, not all of them, are thermally sensitive, if you can heat up the cancer material a little bit more than the basic material around the cancer, it will die faster. And that heating can be done, in some cases, very selectively with an RF probe of various kinds. There's various ways you can focus RF energy on a particular person's particular organ by using something almost like holography techniques, three-dimensional imaging. I'm sending radio waves in there, or by putting RF energy into the equivalent of a catheter and putting the catheter in the right spot to heat up that particular tissues, or to literally inject it with a hypodermic needle and do heating. So some of that is quite successful. When it comes to solving cancer, one of the biggest cancer causes, you would never believe it, there is a YouTube video. I'm going to have to find the URL for it. A very good set of science programs. It's called Veritasium. This guy named Derek Mueller, I think his name, from Australia, has been making a whole series of about 100 YouTube videos to teach you something very useful about science. Let me drop. And if you Google the word Veritasium, V-A-R-I-T-A-S-I-U-M, I think it is. I'm not quite sure what it stands for. Veritasium and nuclear testing. What Derek Mueller did was he visited all the very high radiation locations that you can find on planet Earth. He went to Chernobyl with his Geiger counter and walked around and made a bunch of measurements. He went to Fukushima, Japan, and made a whole bunch of measurements. He found nuclear waste sites in Russia, and he made a bunch of measurements. He was looking for the most dangerous nuclear location on planet Earth. He tried to visit every one of them and make measurements. And so the most dangerous one I remember he found is at a certain spot in Fukushima, Japan, after that tsunami situation. He found places where the nuclear radiation of the soil and other products is so high that you can only dwell there for a couple of minutes before you get a nearly lethal dose, or at least a lethal dose that should not be exceeded for a one-year period, if you know what I mean. Let me drop. So this was fascinating to watch. But then the end of that program, the final line was a mind-blower to me. And that is, you have to realize that when some object is giving off these nuclear particles, which are really atomic-sized bullets coming off that material, you and I call it nuclear radiation. But if you had the world's best microscope, in theory you would see these bullets coming out of there, microscopic, atom-sized bullets coming out at nearly the speed of light. And you can't even see them, but when they penetrate your body, you don't even feel them. They're doing damage. And so the amount of damage you get from being near a nuclear material, a nuclear-emitting material, or radioactive material, is a function of how strong is the radiation coming out of the material, how close are you to it, because nuclear radiation is just like radio. It obeys the inverse square law. Every time you double the distance between you and that emitter, you get one quarter the amount of dose. So you want to put as much distance between you and it as possible. And in the case of nuclear radiation, let me drop it. It primarily accumulates. If you get a dose of two rads today and two rads tomorrow, then your total dose, you would think it would be four rads. It's around 3.9, because the body does a little bit of repair in between, but it does accumulate. So how strong is the source, how close are you to it, and how long are you there? So it's a combination of strength, distance, and time. That's what determines the dose. Therefore, you would say to yourself, okay, where is the strongest dose I can get for the shortest distance for the greatest amount of time? And it turns out that the worst place on planet Earth you could go to, that's probably 50 or 100 times greater than the worst place in Fukushima. I could ask a whole lot of people where that place would be. You would never guess it. When you hear the answer, you say, wow, oh yeah. Now, it turns out that almost everything you and I can touch, Tony, to some very small degree, is radioactive. At first you'd say, well, this luminous dial on my watch is radioactive. Yes, that's true, but it's very small and very safe. It turns out that you and I might like to eat bananas, and he used a banana as an example, because one of the reasons we eat a banana is that it's high in potassium. Let me drop. And potassium is one of the materials that's pretty easier to make it slightly radioactive. All the potassium you and I eat has some background radiation to it. It's darn small, but you and I could, with an accurate scintillation counter, we could measure the amount of radiation coming from almost every banana that you and I buy, because the potassium in it is slightly radioactive. And he was using, as all these examples of going to Fukushima and Chernobyl and other places, how many hundreds, thousands of whatever bananas you'd have to eat to get that same amount of dose to your body. So, once again now, how strong is the source, how close are you to it, and how long is it there? You put that all together, the biggest nuclear radiation that every citizen you and I know is getting is cigarette smoke. It turns out the particles of cigarette smoke are only very mildly radioactive. But when those particles get deposited on your lung, what is the distance? One cell diameter between that particle and your very delicate lung tissue. One cell distance, which is some number of nanometers, extremely close, okay? So the distance is small, that's bad. How long is the exposure? The stuff you deposit on your lung because you're a cigarette smoker, it's there for years. The distance is small, the time is long, even though the dose is small, it accumulates like crazy. Let me drop. So he didn't say it, and I'm making a guess. We think that the carcinogenic characteristics of cigarette smoke is because the tar and nicotine, and there's roughly 1,000 individual chemicals that are generated in cigarette smoke. And we thought it's the chemistry being toxic, giving people lung cancer. As I watched that program, I suddenly realized, whoa, it might be radiation, nuclear radiation. Because the material is only very, very mildly radioactive, but you can't get any closer than one cell distance. You can't get a more delicate organ than the surface of your lung tissue inside of the trachea, if you know what I mean, in an individual air sacs of your lung. And at the time, the stuff sits there for years. So the possibility exists that, I don't know the exact number, he gave it in that program. I think the possibility is that cigarette smoke is something like 1,000 times more nuclear dangerous than sitting on that pile of radioactive material in Fukushima, Japan. Ain't that crazy? Who would have ever guessed that one, Tony? KC2, UJL, K2IW in the TechNet.
So I got one more question and I'm out of here. The nuclear tests that we did in Nevada in the early 50s of the atom bomb, would you say, with your knowledge, that some of that material, those particles, are still in the atmosphere today?
There's a great big yes and a no to that one, Tony. When it comes to atmospheric testing, some of those particles were put into the atmosphere, and are some of them still there? Without a doubt. The percentage of them might be extremely small. But yes, because of the arms limitation agreements, by the way, there's a guy who has just issued a book a couple of weeks ago, a 2004 book that my wife bought for me, a man who lives on Long Island, who published this very good book, because he worked for a number of years at Los Alamos and then worked for Brookhaven Laboratory, and he's describing what life is like. A hell of a lot of the nuclear testing in Nevada was done underground. In the underground testing, almost none of that gets released to the atmosphere. So that's where the majority of the nuclear weapon development took place, underground. And we had to discontinue the atmospheric testing because they could estimate how many thousands of people would in a lifetime get cancer because of the nuclear fallout of atmospheric testing. Wait for the beep before you talk, Tony. KC2UJL, K2IW.
I believe it was measured in Rankin's with a special meter at that time. The Manhattan Project and all that other stuff, you know, back in the 50s. So I'm just saying, I mean, from the 50s till the present day, you know, same thing with in Russia, where that nuclear plant blew up. You know, that's still burning. I think it's still burning down below the ground there. But I'd like to get your answer on that, KC2UJL.
I don't know the amount of material that's in the atmosphere, Tony. And I'm not going to lose a whole lot of sleep over it because I can't do much about it. But we stopped air testing for that reason. In any of these scientific areas, in the beginning we did foolish things and we got smarter. I mean, Madame Curie, who got two separate Nobel Prizes for her work on nuclear research, basically died because of the amount of radiation exposure she gave her body in the process of doing that research. So all of these places that we do research, there's a risk-benefit ratio. Ultimately, you get a lot of benefits out of a lot of research. Sometimes you take some risks in the beginning because you don't know what is dangerous, but you eventually find out. Knowledge is power, and if you're a curious person, you want to know what Mother Nature is telling you, so to speak. There's a very abstract and abstruse message that Mother Nature is giving us, but there's a lot of stuff to study to try to find out. How does medicine work? How does chemistry work? How does gravity work? How do electronics work? No matter what, I mean, NASA gave us a lot of benefits when it comes to certain kinds of electronics and computers and computing techniques for putting things into space and predicting where the orbits are going to be. So, yes, you can easily say we're wasting money that can be used in some other place. No matter how you spend your money, you're spending it wrong because somebody's going to disagree. There's no perfect solution, if you know what I mean. Let me drop. So we don't have a heck of a lot of choice. There was something I was going to ask. Let's see, I did? Oh, yes. While we still have you, Paul, the alpha magnetic spectrometer, this really potent gamma ray detector that was put on the International Space Station, I haven't heard any recent words from it, or maybe I just haven't looked at the right NASA websites. However, I know that it was measuring cosmic rays that were tremendously more powerful, gamma rays, than that we had ever seen before, and it was also measuring a whole lot of antimatter, positrons, and things like this. In other words, positive polarity electrons. When you have the right kind of detector, you find out that an awful lot of those cosmic rays seem to be antimatter, and a surprising amount of it. That would almost lead you to believe that some of those galaxies out there may be made out of antimatter, and we're about made out of matter, if you know what I mean. So I wonder if you've heard any words about the alpha magnetic spectrometer. I think that's an experiment that's going to go on for a significant number of years. WS2N, K2LIW in the TechNet.
That going, because they don't need to keep the cryogenic system going on that. You know, it's very self-contained. It'll stay operational as long as the space station is up there, and we know that's going to be up until at least 2024. But no, I haven't heard any following results. I know they're going to investigate trying to by looking for all the particles that you just mentioned, you know, through that, they might be able to get an idea of what dark matter is. I know they're investigating that. I haven't heard anything that I'm following these four spacecraft that are going to be launched at one time, though, and that I want to see. I'm just trying to figure out how far they're going to keep them apart, you know, one another. Going to be relatively close to one another. See what they come up with, this magnetic reconnection, they call it. So it sounds like as a magnetic field reconnects, it lets out a tremendous amount of energy. By studying the Earth, they're going to be able to study the, extrapolate to all these other different parts of the universe, the sun and the black holes and all. Got to look for this flight March 12th. From Cape Canaveral, Atlas 5 vehicle.
That magnetic field at our planet is extremely important to us. At first you think, well, the only benefit we get out of it is it helps our compass tell you where north is. It does a hell of a lot more than that. A large number of those cosmic rays, a large number of those solar wind particles that are charged, an awful lot of the stuff that would be hitting Earth first hits that Earth magnetic field, even though you and I would think it's a very weak magnetic field. It goes lots of thousands of miles in space. It really is a shield, very similar to, in Star Trek, we say, put up the shields. In other words, it's gonna protect you from various weapons. Well, those cosmic rays and that solar wind represents a kind of a weapon. Let me drop. And those charged particles hit that magnetic field and get deflected. A significant percentage of them end up bouncing back and forth between the North Pole and the South Pole in the so-called Van Allen belts. There's an inner and outer Van Allen belt, and these particles get trapped in that magnetic field. Mars has cooled off. Its core probably used to be liquid. It probably had a liquid core just like the Earth does, and the rotation of that liquid core is a kind of a dynamo that in some people's mind is believed to be one of the mechanisms by which Earth develops a magnetic field. Mars cooled off, its core became solid, it's no longer liquid, no longer rotating. That may be one of the reasons why Mars has essentially lost all of its magnetic field. As such, all of those charged particles from the sun have for the last billions of years been peeling away the atmosphere of Mars, and now Mars is down to 0.07 or 0.7, an extremely small percentage of the atmosphere that we have on Earth probably existed on Mars. It's been peeled away. Partially, it's been peeled away because Mars is smaller, has less gravity, it's not as good at holding on to its atmosphere, but without that magnetic field, wow. There are lots of people who think. I think I heard one of the reports, let me drop this. One of the reports was that when it comes to signing up for a one-way trip to Mars, something like 100,000 people have volunteered. And it's been pared down to a very small fraction of that number. But some ridiculous number of people think they want to go to Mars one way and die there as a pioneer. I'm amazed that many people will volunteer for that. But you're going to a place that is extremely cold. It's almost a vacuum by Earth standards. So it's got no atmosphere. It's got no heat. You're going to be continuously bombarded with cosmic rays and solar wind particles because there is no local magnetic field to protect you. An extremely hostile place to put a human being. And any moving around on Mars is going to have to be in a spacesuit. And when you talk about a spacewalk of an astronaut on an international space station, it sounds glamorous. For a couple hours, you breathe pure oxygen, you purge your body of nitrogen so you don't get the bends, you climb into the suit that has very low internal pressure, you're living on pure oxygen for the time being, and you put on this great big diaper in the bottom of your body to handle the waste products that are being generated. Would you like to live day in and day out in a spacesuit in order to move around on Mars? I can't see how anybody would think that that is a desirable place to go. To put a Spirit, an Opportunity, and a Curiosity rover vehicle on Mars. Let me drop it. That makes a lot of sense. So to put a human being there, it's going to take you a year of travel to get there at extremely high risk. You're not going to be able to come back. The chances of surviving very long are not very good. And it's not a fun place to go. It is the coldest, driest desert that you and I can envision. By the way, here's the question I wanted to ask you, Paul. And that is, in the case of Dawn, what is the number of kilowatts of power that's required to run that ionic engine? And where is that power coming from? I don't think Dawn has solar cells. I'm guessing it's got a nuclear source. So how many watts of power goes into that ionic engine? And where is that power coming from? WS2N, K2RIW.
I think that down to 750 watts, I think that's what the number is out at distance there, roughly 2 AU. At 1 AU where there's gonna be a 4-to-1 ratio where they are. With Dawn. And yeah, have the solar panels, if you look at them, they probably about 40 feet long each one. But that's how they get their power. No RTG, just a solar panel.
I'm a little bit amazed by that because the solar panels are operating in the asteroid belt, which is between Mars and Jupiter. That's a long distance from the Earth. My guess is you're out there at about 3 or 4 astronomical units. And by inverse square law, the amount of solar energy you're getting is extremely small. Therefore, you need huge solar cells. The huge solar cells have got mass, and therefore your ionic engine is pushing that mass. They would get a lot more thrust per pound if they had done it with a reactive, an RTG, radioactive thermal generator. So I'm a bit amazed that Dawn used solar cells in that RTG. Do you think that was done for cost reasons or because there are lots of people who don't like us launching radioactive spacecraft? Over to you for a guess on that one, Paul. WS2N, K2RIW.
And no good. They wouldn't be able to use that. Each RTG will give them 103 watts. usually the number. I mean, some of the spacecraft are, for instance, Cassini and Voyager. They have three on board. Curiosity has the one, so you get the 103 watts. And you need more than that for the...